So our next case for argument is Julian v. Hanna. Mr. Kanovitz.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, it has taken 12 years for the Court to get here, but you are finally presented with the case that was predicted when this Court decided Newsom v. McCabe. Billy Julian was maliciously prosecuted by men cloaked in the authority of the law, and the state of Indiana affords him no remedy for that malicious prosecution. Now, presented with those facts, there's three ways that the Court can go. First, you can stick with Newsom as it is limited and remand with a malicious prosecution claim grounded in the procedural due process clause, a federal malicious prosecution claim. You can take a step back and see what your sister circuits have done in the last 12 years and join the vast majority of them that recognize a malicious prosecution claim that is grounded in the Fourth Amendment itself. Or you can do both. You can recognize both claims because there is nothing inconsistent between a claim grounded in a textual source and a procedural due process claim where state law provides no post-deprivation remedy. And although Mr. Julian wins no matter which path you choose, I would argue and I would urge you to adopt the third path, because Newsom standing alone is a patchwork that leaves some unseemly holes in the coverage of the protections provided by federal law for people who are deprived of their liberty.
Even if it's patchwork, isn't that what Justice Kennedy and was it Justice Souter wrote?
I think it was Kennedy and Thomas.
Thomas.
In the concurrence.
Thomas, excuse me.
Correct. They did.
So how can we fix that?
Well, they did not say that there was no claim under the Fourth Amendment. What they said was there is no claim under the substantive due process aspect of the procedural due process clause. And we are not asking you to recognize a substantive due process claim. We are asking you to recognize a procedural due process, to follow through on the procedural due process claim grounded in Newsom, as well or to follow your sister circuits in grounding a malicious prosecution claim in the Fourth Amendment. When I say that Newsom is a patchwork which can be avoided by joining your sister circuits.
I don't understand. I thought if we agree with you that Indiana didn't provide any remedy here, why do we have to overrule Newsom?
You don't. It's perfectly Mr. Julian wins if you remand on that basis alone. But you could recognize two separate claims.
What would be the difference between them?
The truth is I am not exactly certain, other than there would be two different constitutional sources for it.
I'm trying to imagine how one would instruct a jury so that it might come out differently on the two claims. And if you don't understand it, I'm not going to.
Let me step away from it. Primarily, the point
what
is.
Would the difference be that if Indiana imposed some restrictions on a malicious prosecution suit against public officers, but not a complete bar to liability, then under the Albright Peratt type of thinking, that would be the exclusive remedy.
As long as it is an adequate remedy.
So, because the remedy would be adequate, could be adequate, even though it was more limited than would be a pure Fourth Amendment remedy.
That's a very fair point.
My question, though, is I'm trying to understand the difference between a Fourth Amendment remedy and a procedural due process remedy for malicious prosecution.
So as Judge Posner pointed out, the one difference is that there is no need to demonstrate the inadequacy of state law to proceed.
Okay, and maybe not, but let's suppose we know that Indiana says there's no remedy here. So should we I'm trying to imagine what a trial would be like if we remand the case with both a Fourth Amendment and a malicious prosecution.
As to this particular case?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have not thought through how the jury instructions would differ, if at all. I think once you're in the realm of federal malicious prosecution, it probably, in terms of the elements, it would not differ. And in terms of the remedies, it would not differ. The scope of damages should be the same.
Could you address, counsel, this issue that arose? The defense is relying on the exception to the immunity for both false imprisonment and false arrest. Could you address why those, in your view, would not be sufficient to provide a remedy here?
Sure. And there's two primary reasons. I think the easiest is to look at what Peratt said. In that case, it said there's an adequate state law remedy because it provides, quote unquote, full compensation for the property that he lost. Now, there's certainly suggestions in the jurisprudence that the damages available under federal law don't have to match.
I don't think that's responsive. I thought the problem was that the false imprisonment tort ends when you're charged.
That's correct. I should have started there.
You have to have malicious prosecution to get damages after that.
Absolutely. They're different torts covering different sets of damages.
In terms of time.
Absolutely.
Correct? Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Wallace makes that line very, very stark.
Mm-hmm.
So moving from that point, which is the overwhelming majority of all the damages here are based upon what happened after legal process issued in Mr. Julian's case, you have to ask yourself, could that tiny little remedy possibly be adequate within the concept of what the federal law protects? And it just can't. I mean, Parrott said full compensation. If you want to analogize, and it's a rough analogy to the Bivens jurisprudence about state remedies substituting, it says roughly the same compensation. This doesn't come close. It does not even scratch the surface. And so there is not any reason why this court shouldn't immediately decide that Newsom has now been triggered. There is no state law remedy, and there is absolutely the situation where criminal proceedings have been wrongfully initiated for malicious purposes and without probable cause. Moving on to the Fourth Amendment point, if for some reason the court doesn't want to go that way, then your sister circuits have all felt the need to address the fact that malicious prosecution does affect federal interests under some circumstances. They've grounded it in the Fourth Amendment. As I said, if necessary, it's consistent to recognize both. And since I do not know how you're going to rule on the adequacy, but I think that the adequacy should certainly be found, as we have argued, to be completely inadequate, I would say that both of those options are available to you. If there are no other questions.
Could you address some of the timeliness issues, in particular this question about the equitable estoppel response to the statute of limitations defense on your Brady claims?
So just to be clear, the timeliness issue is purely a Brady claim issue because malicious prosecution, like any tort, can't accrue until all the elements are present, and conclusion of the criminal proceedings is one of those elements. So moving to the Brady claim, we have alleged equitable estoppel as a reason why, even though we admit the Brady claim accrued and more than 2 years, which is the statute of limitations passed, that defense should be equitably estopped. That is a fact-bound defense. We have raised it in the context of a motion to dismiss. And we have not received a response to it either by the district court or in our pleadings in this court. The district court notes in its ruling on the motion to dismiss that we have raised that as an issue, and then it just vanishes. There is no ruling. So the proper resolution here is for this court to remand to the district court and to include the instruction to consider that issue.
What is the Brady claim? Or the Brady claims, what do they add? If you are able to pursue the malicious prosecution claim?
As a matter of damages, they don't add anything. As a matter of where the different ways a jury might slice and dice the evidence, they add a method of recovery even if for some reason the jury felt there was probable cause. So, for example, if the jury thought that there was probable cause for a malicious for bringing the proceedings, we would lose our federal malicious prosecution claim. It is consistent, though, to have a criminal
probable
proceeding
cause.
Initiated on probable cause, but then the exculpatory evidence is hidden from you.
Let me ask you a question. Why is Franklin LaPelle Community School Corporation a defendant?
It should not be a defendant. And in fact, in the briefing in the district court, we didn't even respond to it.
What about the town of Frankton?
The town itself, we have adequately pled Monell claims against, and actually they haven't challenged the adequacy of the pleading of the Monell claim in this appeal.
So they did not seek dismissal in the lower court.
Only on the grounds that would support the idea that there's no constitutional violation.
Right. Yes. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Kanovitz. Mr. Stewart?
May it please the Court, my name is Ian Stewart. I represent William Amick and Franklin LaPelle School District, but I'll be speaking on behalf of all the defendants. The primary argument that I want to address right off the bat is that the heart of plaintiff's case, his arrest, his detention, his the withholding of any exculpatory evidence, his conviction, his imprisonment, all of that is barred by the statute of limitations. The plaintiffs have tried to minimize that, push that back. But that is truly the heart of his case, and that's all barred by the statute of limitations.
How can that be if the malicious prosecution tort requires the favorable termination of the criminal proceedings?
Under Heck and how this court has interpreted Heck, if you're going to bring any claim, and specifically it was in the Del Real versus Gomez case, where the court said the claim was a wrongful prosecution and any trial-related activity. And the court said, okay, fine, if you're going to bring that, that accrues when your conviction has been reversed.
Now, the concern that I have, first of all, the criminal proceedings were not terminated until the dismissal of the charges. And he still faced fresh charges, he faced a new trial, and it's been alleged, continuing efforts to intimidate witnesses, conceal evidence, etc. So, arguably, there's a continuing wrong here. Even without that, though, if we were to accept your theory on statute of limitations, what you would seem to be proposing is that the plaintiff in this case would have to file suit while the criminal charges are still pending against him, and he and everyone else involved would be facing parallel state criminal prosecution and federal civil proceedings. And that seems to be exactly contrary to what Heck really had in mind.
Except the Supreme Court said that's exactly what you do. For instance, in a false arrest claim.
Where has it told us to do that?
In a false arrest claim.
That's very different. That's the very short time frame, right?
But you still would have the concurring.
Issue would not in that case be guilt or innocence on the underlying charge the way it would be in the proposal that you're giving us.
It would be. If you were under the Albright, they say, okay, you need to file your Wallace versus Cato. You need to file your false arrest claim. And you'd be arguing there's no probable cause. But you need to do that while the criminal case is going on. Now the civil case can be stayed, so you don't have the inconsistent verdicts.
So what would be the point of requiring a plaintiff to file a case when it would have to be stayed?
There's a statute of limitations, and that is...
Which would serve what purpose under these circumstances?
Well, it would depend on what the... In this case, plaintiff is saying, I was wrongly convicted. I spent all this time in prison because you withheld evidence. Fine. Under Heck, once his conviction was reversed, he could sue under that. He had all the evidence he needed. He had all the facts he needed. That's when he should have filed a lawsuit. Otherwise, now we're 4 or 5 years out from that.
Except that he didn't have the termination of... he didn't have the if he'd sued then, you all would have said, you're too early. He hasn't had the charges against him resolved. Am I correct, Mr. Stewart, that you all are essentially agreeing that the district judge's reasoning on the issue of state remedy was indefensible?
No, we're not, Your Honor.
You want to try to defend it?
I will defend it, Your Honor. I view it as basically there are two prosecutions here. There is a prosecution leading up to the conviction, which was set aside, and then there was the later prosecution, which was dismissed. Involving the prosecution from 2007 to 2010. There, you don't even get to whether there was a necessary remedy, civil remedy, because under Parrott, you first have to see whether, and under Newsom, whether the person seized by the state had an adequate opportunity to defend himself in the criminal prosecution. Well, after the conviction was reversed, there's no allegation that he didn't have adequate opportunity to defend himself. In fact, he did. All the evidence was present. He was aware of the evidence involving the two Brooks brothers and whether they were or were not at the school parking lot. And, in fact, the case was dismissed.
I don't understand the adequacy of his state remedy.
Well, that has, under the first part of Parrott, it's whether he had an adequate opportunity to defend himself under Newsom. So that's the first part. And regarding the second part of the prosecution, he did have an adequate opportunity to defend himself.
So if you know that the evidence against you is false, then you have an adequate remedy and you win the case and you have no damages remedy. Is that right?
For the second part. After 2007.
He spent years in prison and there's no remedy.
Or you've undergone the stress and expense of defending yourself even if you weren't in custody. I assume there are still restrictions on liberty for somebody who's facing such serious charges in state court, right?
There is not, Your Honor.
Pretrial release?
Under Tully, this court found that simply having false allegations is not a seizure. There is no seizure. Which is why, if you're simply being summoned court has decided you don't have a malicious, you don't have a 14th Amendment, you don't have a 4th Amendment malicious prosecution.
What if you want to travel abroad? Would he have been allowed to do that?
He was released, he was brought, there was no seizure. He was not in custody.
Was there any restraint on his liberty?
I'm not aware of any. The courts, when they set it aside, simply said he was remanded on his own recognizance, and the conviction was set aside. Now, turning to whether there was a state law remedy for the actions that occurred before his conviction was reversed when he was in prison. The answer is yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, in the Kim versus Ritter case noted that Indiana has a malicious prosecution claim, and therefore he can bring this claim.
When was that case?
That was a 2012 case. It was a Seventh Circuit case, Kim versus Ritter.
What about the immunity? I don't understand.
Well, the immunity wouldn't apply to everyone. If plaintiff
Wait a second. What applies to him, though?
Well, it wouldn't apply to all possible defendants.
Who would it apply? Who would it not apply to?
If plaintiff was dead set on bringing a malicious prosecution claim, and he's saying the two Brooks brothers, they made up a story, and because of that I got prosecuted, he would have had a malicious prosecution claim against them.
Okay, but the Constitution is really worried about state action. And all the state actors seem to be covered by the Tort Claim Act immunity, right?
They, except as we mentioned, they would not be covered from immunity from false arrest. They would not be covered from...
We know that. We're talking about malicious prosecution.
And as Newsom was set up, did you have an adequate opportunity to obtain compensation? It doesn't say on this specific claim against this specific actor.
Find your argument.
So he did have a chance for...
Preposterous, basically. You're saying these people have no remedy against state actors, you're saying.
For malicious prosecution. That's not to say they didn't have a compensation for false arrest, for false imprisonment.
No, but they can't use false imprisonment once they've been charged.
False arrest and false imprisonment here are measured in hours. The damages here are measured in years.
And what we would argue is they would get some compensation. They could have other compensation against non-state actors.
Oh, come on. Collect damages against these other people? Come on.
It might be difficult, but it's an opportunity for compensation.
I don't know why you make such a terrible argument.
But just because some actors, are, for instance, prosecutors or courts,
just
are given...
Just because. There's no adequate remedy for someone in his situation. There isn't the beginning of an adequate remedy.
Mr. Stewart, can I ask you, I was looking in your brief for some discussion of our decision in Belcher against Norton, which in essence ruled the way the plaintiffs think we ought to rule with respect to Indiana, where property has been deprived without due process of law. The argument seems pretty clear. I didn't see any response.
There you had a case where property was seized, and they were trying to say, well, compensate me for my seized property, and there was a complete – there was nothing they could do against any state actor. There was no remedy at all.
This sounds familiar.
We would argue there is a remedy, and also –
which this is the false imprisonment, false arrest stuff for a few hours?
It's limited. Well, no, it's not for
– I don't understand how you can make an argument like this with a straight face. Peratt, Albright, these are cases which say it's not a violation of due process if a state is providing an adequate remedy against the state actors, right? Because it's only the state actors who can be sued for constitutional violations.
I don't believe Albright...
This remedy you provide is not remotely adequate. So I don't understand how, with a straight face, you can think that your position is compliant with Peratt.
I don't think Peratt says it has to be full. It can be limited.
It's not a question of full. Do you really regard these remedies, false arrest and false imprisonment before the person is charged, as an adequate remedy if someone spends years in prison because of willful misconduct by state actors?
In addition to the remedy...
You answer me. You say yes.
Yes, I do. In addition to the remedy...
Your position is ridiculous.
In addition to the remedy against
the witnesses... You can call this adequate? Can you call this an adequate remedy? These false arrests? Even if it's a thousandth of what... Of what he would be entitled to if there were no immunity?
Once again, that's ignoring the fact he can go after the witnesses who he says lied about him being present.
The witnesses are irrelevant because the idea is to provide an adequate remedy against the state actors. It has nothing to do with private people who are sued.
If I'm remembering correctly, the witnesses get absolute immunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, for their trial testimony, for any testimony they would have given to the prosecutor or to the police to get the ball rolling, they would not have absolute immunity. And then also the fact that they are awarded due process, the plaintiff would be awarded due process because these are legislative immunities and there was the legislative process which created the immunities.
How do you reconcile that with Peratt? It's created, but how do you reconcile it with Peratt?
That if the purpose is to create some type of process, they could amend...
The constitutional protections that we're talking about here are designed to protect individuals and minorities from oppressive acts of state actors and majorities. And saying that the majority decided there should be no remedy through the legislative process really doesn't answer the problem.
Your reference to legislative due process is peculiarly inadequate because what you're saying is that the legislature could say there's absolutely no remedy, no false arrest, no false imprisonment, no nothing for any victim of state actor violations of the Constitution. And that's fine because we accorded the plaintiff legislative due process. That's your argument. You're really going to make that with a straight face?
Well, as I've already...
I don't say well, yes or no. Is that your position? As long as the state legislature has removed the remedies, that's fine. There's no remedy.
I think that's a possibility. But in this case, that had not occurred.
That's a possibility? I don't think it's possible for a lawyer to make a responsible argument of that sort, that a state legislature can remove all federal constitutional protections from citizens simply by a legislative enactment. I don't think a lawyer can argue that.
Mr. Stewart, could I ask you about something else?
Sure.
You all wrote in a footnote in your brief that you thought that our court's jurisprudence allowing plaintiffs to elaborate on appeal on the allegations in their complaint runs contrary to Twombly and Iqbal. If I recall correctly, Iqbal itself allowed remand for further amendment of the complaint. So I really don't see the tension there, particularly since so many plaintiffs face moving targets with respect to these pleading standards these days.
Iqbal, and the purpose of why we left it in footnote form is to elaborate on further, was there seems to be some inconsistency with Iqbal saying you need to allege all your factual allegations in your complaint, but then to say, oh, no, for this circuit to say, no, even on appeal you can start.
Well, it's not inconsistent with Iqbal to allow a plaintiff to amend the complaint, correct?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And so he can amend the complaint, and he did.
Even after a remand from the Supreme Court, he can amend the complaint.
Correct.
So why not allow people to actually explain the foundation of their case when they get up here on appeal?
Mm-hmm. It would make Iqbal seem kind of surplus if you can simply add new facts. I see my time is up.
I have one very small question. Do you agree that Town of Frankton did not move below for dismissal of the Monell claim?
I don't represent the Town of Frankton. I represent the Frankton-LaPelle School District. We did move for Monell. I believe we were the only ones who did, but
We'll double check.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, but we'd argue that, once again, everything is far less definite.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Canavas, do you have anything further?
Just very, very briefly, some points of clarification. First, there was not two prosecutions here. There was one prosecution here. If you look at the record, the charges that were filed against him continued all the way through until it was dismissed. Secondly, the point about Tully, you know, we absolutely have a protected interest here. Tully's our case. There's a gigantic caveat in Tully, a case which literally involved nothing malicious at all and didn't even involve an arrest, that said we are not talking in this case about, and it gives a list of egregious police misconduct, and one of those is malicious prosecution. And that follows up on Judge Kennedy's Albright concurrence, which we've said is the state of the Albright law, where he says we can assume that many of the interests protected by the common law in its development of malicious prosecution are also protected by the Due Process Clause, and he mentioned specifically the interest against malicious prosecution. Even if we didn't have that, under an incredibly restrictive interpretation, we got Paul V. Davies-type damages. Mr. Julian could not get a job between the time he was released and the time his conviction, and time the charges were dropped, because there were these malicious charges pending against him.
Were there restrictions on his travel or other liberty?
Yeah, he had standard sets of pretrial restrictions. You have to have permission to leave the jurisdiction, et cetera.
One would hope.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Can't carry a firearm, I assume.
I don't know that for sure, but I know that it was a standard set, so I would think
under
that would
federal be. Law, you cannot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it would be a crime for somebody even facing that charge to possess a firearm.
Mm. Thank you. And then finally, you know, the concept that Wallace's file and stay rule has anything to do with this case is a fiction. You know, Wallace is addressed only to cases that accrue at the time that legal process issues, wrongful arrest, and that type of case. You can't file a malicious prosecution case until your case ends because it hasn't accrued yet. File and stay has nothing to do with it. And so unless there's any further questions, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Canavas.